The sail was almost on him. A few moments more, and the ship would be safely past, and he could die in peace. His hand reached for his throat, fumbling for the small leather pouch he always wore about his neck. Inside he kept the bones of the four fingers his king had shortened for him, on the day he made Davos a knight.
My luck.
His shortened fingers patted at his chest, groping, finding nothing. The pouch was gone, and the finger bones with them. Stannis could never understand why he'd kept the bones.
To remind me of my king's justice, he whispered through cracked lips.
But now they were gone.
The fire took my luck as well as my son's.
In his dreams the river was still aflame, and demons danced upon the waters with fiery whips in their hands, while men blackened and burned beneath the lash.
Mother, have mercy, Davos prayed. Save me, gentle mother. Save us all. My luck is gone. And my sons.
He was weeping freely now, salt tears streaming down his cheeks.
The fire took it all. The fire.
Perhaps it was only wind blowing against the rock or the sound of the sea on the shore. But for an instant, Davos Seaworth heard her answer.
You call the fire, she whispered,
her voice as faint as the sound of waves in a seashell, sad and soft.
You burned us. Burned us. Burned us. It was her, Davos cried. Mother, don't forsake us. It was her who burned you, the Red Woman. Melisande, her.
He could see her. Her heart-shaped face, the red eyes, the long, coppery hair, the red gowns moving like flames as she walked. A swirl of silk and satin. She had come from Ashai in the east. She had come to Dragonstone and won Selyse and her queen's men for her alien god. And then the king, Stannis Baratheon himself. He had gone so far as to put the fiery heart on his banners, the fiery heart of R'hllor, Lord of Light, and God of Flame and Shadow. At Melisande's urging, he had dragged the seven from their sceptred Dragonstone and burned them before the castle gates, and later had burned the godswood of Storm's End as well, even the heart tree, a huge white weirwood with a solemn face.
It was her work, Davos said again, more weakly. Her work and yours, Onion Knight. You rode her into Storm's End in the black of night, so she might loose her shadow child. You are not guiltless, no. You rode beneath her banner and flew it from your mast. You watched the seven burn at Dragonstone and did nothing. She gave the fathers justice to the fire, and the mothers mercy, and the wisdom of the crone, smith and stranger, maid and warrior. She burned them all to the glory of her cruel god, and you stood and held your tongue. Even when she killed old Maester Cresson, even then, you did nothing.
The sail was 100 yards away and moving fast across the bay. In a few more moments it would be past him and dwindling. Sir Davos Seaworth began to climb his rock. He pulled himself up with trembling hands, his head swimming with fever. Twice his maimed fingers slipped on the damp stone and he almost fell, but somehow he managed to cling to his perch. If he fell, he was dead, and he had to live. For a little while more, at least, there was something he had to do. The top of the rock was too small to stand on safely, as weak as he was, so he crouched and waved his fleshless arms.
"Ship!"
he screamed into the wind.
"Ship here! Here!"
From up here he could see her more clearly, the lean, striped hull, the bronze figurehead, the billowing sail. There was a name painted on her hull, but Davis had never learned to read.
Ship!
He called again.
Help me! Help me!
A crewman on her forecastle saw him and pointed. He watched as other sailors moved to the gunwale to gape at him. A short while later, the galley's sail came down. Her oars slid out, and she swept around towards his refuge. She was too big to approach the rock closely, but 30 yards away she launched a small boat. Davis clung to his rock and watched it creep toward him. 4 men were rowing, while a 5th sat in the prow.
You!
The 5th man called out, when they were only a few feet from his island.
You! Up on the rock! Who are you?
A smuggler who rose above himself, thought Davis. A fool who loved his king too much and forgot his guards.
His
throat was parched, and he had forgotten how to talk. The words felt strange on his tongue, and sounded stranger in his ears.
I was in the battle. I was a captain, a knight. I was a knight.
Aye, sir, the man said, and serving which king?
The galley might be Joffrey's, he realized suddenly. If he spoke the wrong name now, she would abandon him to his fate. But no, her hull was striped. She was Lycene. She was Salador Sans. The mother sent her here. The mother in her mercy. She had a task for him.
Stannis lives, he knew then. I have a king still, and sons. I have other sons, and a wife loyal and loving.
How could he have forgotten? The mother was merciful indeed.
Stannis!
He shouted back at the Lyseni.
Gods be good! I serve King Stannis!
Aye, said the man in the boat.
And so do we.
Sansa. The invitation seemed innocent enough, but every time Sansa read it, her tummy tightened into a knot.
She's to be queen now. She's beautiful and rich, and everyone loves her. Why would she want to sup with a traitor's daughter?
It could be curiosity, she supposed. Perhaps Margaery Tyrell wanted to get the measure of the rival she'd displaced.
Does she resent me, I wonder? Does she think I bear her ill will?
Sansa had watched from the castle walls as Margaery Tyrell and her escort made their way up Aegon's High Hill. Joffrey had met his new bride-to-be at the King's Gate to welcome her to the city, and they rode side by side through cheering crowds. Joff glittering in gilded armour, and the Tyrell girl splendid in green, with a cloak of autumn flowers blowing from her shoulders. She was 16, brown-haired and brown-eyed, slender and beautiful. The people called out her name as she passed, held up their children for her blessing, and scattered flowers under the hooves of her horse. Her mother and grandmother followed close behind, riding in a tall wheelhouse whose sides were carved in the shape of 100 twining roses, every one gilded and shining. The small folk cheered them as well.
"The same small folk who pulled me from my horse and would have killed me, if not for the hound."
Sansa had done nothing to make the commons hate her, no more than Margaery Tyrell had done to win their love.
"Does she want me to love her too?"
She studied the invitation, which looked to be written in Margaery's own hand.
"Does she want my blessing?"
Sansa wondered if Joffrey knew of this supper. For all she knew, it might be his doing. That thought made her fearful. If Joff was behind the invitation, he would have some cruel jape planned to shame her in the older girl's eyes. Would he command his king's guard to strip her naked once again? The last time he had done that, his uncle Tyrion had stopped him, but the imp could not save her now.
"No one can save me but my Florian."
Sir Dontus had promised he would help her escape, but not until the night of Joffrey's wedding. The plans had been well laid,
her dear, devoted knight turned fool, assured her. There was nothing to do until then but endure and count the days.
And sup with my replacement.
Perhaps she was doing Marjorie Tyrell an injustice. Perhaps the invitation was no more than a simple kindness, an act of courtesy.
It might be just a supper.
But this was the Red Keep. This was King's Landing. This was the court of King Joffrey Baratheon, the first of his name, and if there was one thing that Sansa Stark had learned here, it was mistrust. Even so, she must accept. She was nothing now, the discarded daughter of a traitor, and disgraced sister of a rebel lord. She could scarcely refuse Joffrey's queen-to-be.
I wish the Hound were here.
The night of the battle, Sandor Clegane had come to her chambers to take her from the city, but Sansa had refused. Sometimes she lay awake at night, wondering if she'd been wise. She had his stained white cloak hidden in a cedar chest beneath her summer silks. She could not say why she'd kept it. The Hound had turned craven, she'd heard it said, at the height of the battle. He got so drunk, the imp had to take his men. But Sansa understood. She knew the secret of his burned face.
It was only the fire, he feared.
That night, the wildfire had set the river itself ablaze and filled the very air with green flame. Even in the castle, Sansa had been afraid. Outside, she could scarcely imagine it. Sighing, she got out her quill and ink and wrote Marjorie Tyrell a gracious note of acceptance. When the appointed night arrived, another of the King's Guard came for her. A man as different from Sandor Clegane as, well, as a flower from a dog. The sight of Sir Loras Tyrell standing on her threshold made Sansa's heart beat a little faster. This was the first time she had been so close to him since he had returned to King's Landing, leading the vanguard of his father's host. For a moment, she did not know what to say.
"Sir Loras," she finally managed, "you look so lovely."
He gave her a puzzled smile. "My lady is too kind, and beautiful besides. My sister awaits you eagerly.
I've so looked forward to our supper,
as has Marjorie, and my lady grandmother as well." He took her arm and led her toward the steps.
"Your grandmother?"
Sansa was finding it hard to walk and talk and think all at the same time, with Sir Loras touching her arm. She could feel the warmth of his hand through the silk. "Lady Olena, she is to sup with you as well."
"Oh," said Sansa. "I'm talking to him, and he's touching me. He's holding my arm and touching me."
"The Queen of Thorns, she's called, isn't that right?" "It is," Sir Loras laughed.
"He has the warmest laugh," she thought as he went on.
"You'd best not use that name in her presence, though, or you'll like to get pricked." Sansa reddened. Any fool would have realized that no woman could be happy about being called the Queen of Thorns.
"Maybe I truly am as stupid as Cersei Lannister says."
Desperately, she tried to think of something clever and charming to say to him, but her wits had deserted her. She almost told him how beautiful he was, until she remembered she'd already done that.
He was beautiful, though. He seemed taller than he had been when she first met him, but still so lithe and graceful, and Sansa had never seen another boy with such wonderful eyes. "He's no boy, though. He's a man grown, a knight of the King's Guard."
She thought he looked even finer in white than in the green and golds of House Tyrell. The only spot of colour in him now was the brooch that clasped his cloak. The rose of Highgarden, wrought in soft yellow gold, nestled in a bed of delicate green jade leaves. Sir Balin Swan held the door of Maegor's for them to pass. He was all in white as well, though he did not wear it half so well as Sir Loras. Beyond the spiked moat, 2 dozen men were taking their practice with sword and shield. With the castle so crowded, the outer ward had been given over to guests to raise their tents and pavilions, leaving only the smaller inner yards for training.
One of the Red Wine twins was being driven backward by Sir Talad, with the eyes on his shield. Chunky Sir Kennis of Case, who chuffed and puffed every time he raised his longsword, seemed to be holding his own against Usni Kettleblack. But Usni's brother, Sir Osfrid, was savagely punishing the frog-faced squire, Morris Slint. Blunted swords or no, Slint would have a rich crop of bruises by the morrow. It made Sansa wince just to watch. They have scarcely finished burying the dead from the last battle, and already they are practicing for the next one. On the edge of the yard, a lone knight with a pair of golden roses on his shield was holding off three foes. Even as they watched, he caught one of them alongside the head, knocking him senseless. "Is that your brother?" Sansa asked.
"It is, my lady," said Sir Loras. "Garden often trains against three men, or even four. In battle, it is seldom one against one, he says, so he likes to be prepared."
"He must be very brave."
"He is a great knight," Sir Loras replied. "A better sword than me, in truth, though I'm the better lance."
"I remember," said Sansa. "You ride wonderfully, sir."
"My lady is gracious to say so. When has she seen me ride?"
"At the Hand's Tourney. Don't you remember? You rode a white courser, and your armor was 100 different kinds of flowers. You gave me a rose. A red rose. You threw white roses to the other girls that day."
It made her flush to speak of it.
"You said no victory was half as beautiful as me."
Sir Loras gave her a modest smile. "I spoke only a simple truth, that any man with eyes could see."
"He doesn't remember," Sansa realized, startled. "He's only being kind to me. He doesn't remember me, or the rose, or any of it." She had been so certain that it meant something, that it meant everything. A red rose, not a white.
"It was after you unhorsed Sir Robar Royce," she said desperately.
He took his hand from her arm.
"I slew Robar at Storm's End, my lady."
It was not a boast. He sounded sad. "Him and another of King Renly's Rainbow Guard as well, yes." Sansa had heard the women talking of it around the well, but for a moment she'd forgotten.
"That was when Lord Renly was killed, wasn't it? How terrible for your poor sister."
"For Margaery," his voice was tight, "to be sure. She was at Bitterbridge, though. She did not see."
"Even so, when she heard—"
Sir Loras brushed the hilt of his sword lightly with his hand. Its grip was white leather, its pommel a rose in alabaster.
"Renly is dead. Robar as well. What use to speak of them?"
The sharpness in his tone took her aback.
My lord, I did not mean to give offence, sir."
"Nor could you, Lady Sansa," Sir Loras replied, but all the warmth had gone from his voice. Nor did he take her arm again. They ascended the serpentine steps in a deepening silence.
"Why did I have to mention Sir Robar?" Sansa thought. "I've ruined everything. He is angry with me now."
She tried to think of something she might say to make amends, but all the words that came to her were lame and weak.
"Be quiet, or you'll only make it worse," she told herself.
Lord Mace Tyrell and his entourage had been housed behind the royal sept, in the long, slate-roofed keep that had been called the Maiden Vault, since King Baelor the Blessed had confined his sisters therein, so the sight of them might not tempt him into carnal thoughts. Outside its tall carved doors stood two guards in gilded half-helms and green cloaks edged in gold satin, the golden rose of Highgarden sewn on their breasts. Both were seven-footers, wide of shoulder and narrow waist, magnificently muscled. When Sansa got close enough to see their faces, she could not tell one from the other. They had the same strong jaws, the same deep blue eyes, the same thick red moustaches. "Who are they?" she asked Sir Loras, her discomfort forgotten for a moment.
"My grandmother's personal guard," he told her. "Their mother named them Eric and Arik, but grandmother can't tell them apart, so she calls them Left and Right."
Left and Right opened the doors,
and Marjorie Tyrell herself emerged and swept down the short flight of steps to greet them. "Lady Sansa," she called. "I'm so pleased you came. Be welcome." Sansa knelt at the feet of her future queen.
"You do me great honour, Your Grace."
"Won't you call me Marjorie? Please rise. Loras, help the Lady Sansa to her feet. Might I call you, Sansa?"
"If it please you."
Sir Loras helped her up. Marjorie dismissed him with a sisterly kiss and took Sansa by the hand. "Come, my grandmother awaits, and she is not the most patient of ladies." A fire was crackling in the hearth, and sweet-smelling rushes had been scattered on the floor. Around the long trestle table, a dozen women were seated. Sansa recognized only Lord Tyrell's tall, dignified wife, Lady Ellery, whose long silvery braid was bound with jeweled rings. Marjorie performed the other introductions. There were three Tyrell cousins, Megger and Alla and Eleanor, all close to Sansa's age. Buxom Lady Janna was Lord Tyrell's sister and wed to one of the Greenapple Fussaways. Dainty, bright-eyed Lady Leonette was a Fussaway as well and wed to Sir Garlan. Septa Nysterica had a homely, puck-scarred face but seemed jolly. Pale, elegant Lady Graceford was with child, and Lady Bulwer was a child, no more than 8. And Mary was what she was to call boisterous plump Meredith Crane, but most definitely not Lady Merryweather, a sultry, black-eyed Moorish beauty. Last of all, Marjorie brought her before the wizened, white-haired doll of a woman at the head of the table. "I am honoured to present my grandmother, the Lady Alina, widow to the late Luther Tyrell, Lord of Highgarden, whose memory is a comfort to us all." The old woman smelled of rose water.
"Why, she's just the littlest bit of a thing."
There was nothing the least bit thorny about her.
"Kiss me, child,"
Lady Alina said, tugging at Sansa's wrist with a soft-spotted hand.
"It's so kind of you to sup with me and my foolish flock of hens."
Dutifully, Sansa kissed the old woman on the cheek. "It is kind of you to have me, my lady."
"I knew your grandfather, Lord Rickard, though not well."
"He died before I was born."
"I am aware of that, child. It's said that your Tully, grandfather, is dying too, Lord Huster. Surely they told you? An old man, though not so old as me. Still, night falls for all of us in the end, and too soon for some. You would know that more than most, poor child. You've had your share of grief, I know. We are sorry for your losses."
Sansa glanced at Marjorie. "I was saddened when I heard of Lord Renly's death, Your Grace. He was very gallant." "You are kind to say so," answered Marjorie. Her grandmother snorted.
"Gallant, yes, and charming, and very clean. He knew how to dress, and he knew how to smile, and he knew how to bathe, and somehow he got the notion that this made him fit to be king. The Baratheons have always had some queer notions, to be sure. It comes from their Targaryen blood, I should think." She sniffed. "They tried to marry me to a Targaryen once, but I soon put an end to that."
"Renly was brave and gentle, grandmother," said Marjorie. "Father liked him as well, and so did Loras."
"Loras is young,"
Lady Orlena said crisply,
"and very good at knocking men off horses with a stick. That does not make him wise. As to your father, would that I had been born a peasant woman with a big wooden spoon. I might have been able to beat some sense into his fat head."
"Mother!"
Lady O'Leary scolded.
"Hush, O'Leary, don't take that tone with me. And don't call me Mother. If I'd given birth to you, I'm sure I'd remember. I'm only to blame for your husband, the Lord Oaf of Highgarden."
"Grandmother," Marjorie urged, "mind your words, or what will Sansa think of us?"
"She might think we have some wits about us. One of us, at any rate."
The old woman turned back to Sansa.
"It's treason. I warn them. Robert has 2 sons, and Renly has an older brother. How can he possibly have any claim to that ugly iron chair?"
"Tut, tut," says my son. "Don't you want your sweet king to be queen? You Starks were kings once, the Aerons and the Lannisters as well, and even the Baratheons through the female line, but the Tyrells were no more than Stuarts, until Aegon the Dragon came along and cooked the rightful king of the Reach on the Field of Fire. If truth be told, even our claim to Highgarden is a bit dodgy, just as those dreadful Florents are always whining. What does it matter, you ask? Well, of course it doesn't, except to oaths like my son. The thought that one day he may see his grandson with his arse on the Iron Throne makes Mace puff up like... Now, what do you call it? Marjorie, you're clever. Be a dear and tell your poor old half-daft grandmother the name of that queer fish from the Summer Isles, that puffs up to 10 times its own size when you poke it.
They call them pufffish, grandmother.
Of course they do. Summer Islanders have no imagination. My son ought to take the pufffish for his sigil. If truth be told, he could put a crown on it, the way the Baratheons do their stag. Mayhap that would make him happy. We should have stayed well out of all this bloody foolishness, if you ask me. But once the cow's been milked, there's no squirting the cream back up her udder. After Lord Pufffish put that crown on Renly's head, we were into the pudding up to our knees. So, here we are to see things through. And what do you say to that, Sansa?
Sansa's mouth opened and closed. She felt very like a pufffish herself. The Tyrells can trace their descent back to Garth Greenhand, was the best she could manage at short notice. The Queen of Thorns snorted.
Tchah! So can the Florents, the Rowans, the Oakharts, and half the other noble houses of the South. Garth liked to plant his seed in fertile ground, they say. I shouldn't wonder that more than his hands were green.
Sansa, Lady Alera broke in, you must be very hungry. Shall we have a bite of boar together and some lemon cakes?
Lemon cakes are my favourite, Sansa admitted. So we have been told, declared Lady Alena, who obviously had no intention of being hushed, that Varys' creature seemed to think we should be grateful for the information. I've never been quite sure what the point of a eunuch is, if truth be told. It seems to me they're only men, with the useful bits cut off. Ellery, will you have them bring the food, or do you mean to starve me to death? Here, Sansa, sit here, next to me. I'm much less boring than these others. I hope that you're fond of fools.
Sansa smoothed down her skirts and sat.
I think... Fools, my lady? You mean the sort in Motley? Feathers, in this case. What do you imagine I was speaking of? My son? Or these lovely ladies? Now, don't blush. With your hair, it makes you look like a pomegranate. All men are fools, if truth be told, but the ones in Motley are more amusing than ones with crowns. Marjorie, child, summon Butterbumps. Let us see if we can't make Lady Sansa smile. The rest of you, be seated. Do I have to tell you everything? Sansa must think that my granddaughter is attended by a flock of sheep.
Butterbumps arrived before the food, dressed in a jester suit of green and yellow feathers with a floppy coxcomb. An immense round fat man, as big as 3 moon boys. He came cartwheeling into the hall, vaulted onto the table, and laid a gigantic egg right in front of Sansa.
"Break it, my lady," he commanded.
When she did, a dozen yellow chicks escaped and began running in all directions.
"Catch them!" Butterbumps exclaimed.
Little Lady Bulwer snagged one and handed it to him, whereby he tilted back his head, popped it into his huge rubbery mouth, and seemed to swallow it whole. When he belched, tiny yellow feathers flew out of his nose. Lady Bulwer began to wail in distress, but her tears turned into a sudden squeal of delight when the chick came squirming out of the sleeve of her gown and ran down her arm. As the servants brought forth a broth of leeks and mushroom, Butterbumps began to juggle, and Lady Alena pushed herself forward to rest her elbows on the table.
Do you know my son, Sansa, Lord Pufffish of Highgarden?
A great lord, Sansa answered politely.
A great oaf, said the Queen of Thorns. His father was an oaf as well. My husband, the late Lord Luther. Oh, I loved him well enough, don't mistake me. A kind man and not unskilled in the bedchamber, but an appalling oaf all the same. He managed to ride off a cliff whilst hawking. They say he was looking up at the sky and paying no mind to where his horse was taking him. And now my oaf son is doing the same, only he's riding a lion instead of a palfrey. It's easier to mount a lion, and not so easy to get off, I warned him. But he only chuckles. Should you ever have a son, Sansa, beat him frequently, so he learns to mind you. I only had the one boy, and I hardly beat him at all, so now he pays more heed to Butterbumps than he does to me. A lion is not a lap cat, I told him, and he gives me a tut-tut, mother. There is entirely too much tut-tutting in this realm, if you ask me. All these kings would do a great deal better if they put down their swords and listened to their mothers.
Sansa realized that her mouth was open again. She filled it with a spoon of broth, while Lady Ellaire and the other women were giggling at the spectacle of Butterbumps bouncing oranges off his head, his elbows, and his ample rump.
"I want you to tell me the truth about this royal boy," said Lady Alina abruptly. "This Joffrey."
Sansa's fingers tightened around her spoon.
"The truth? I can't. Don't ask it, please. I can't.
You, yes. Who would know better? The lad seems kingly enough, I'll grant you. A bit full of himself, but that would be his Lannister blood. We've heard some troubling tales, however. Is there any truth to them? Has this boy mistreated you?"
Sansa glanced about nervously. Butterbumps popped a whole orange into his mouth, chewed and swallowed, slapped his cheek, and blew seeds out of his nose. The women giggled and laughed. Servants were coming and going, and the maiden vault echoed to the clatter of spoons and plates. One of the chicks hopped back onto the table and ran through Lady Grace Ford's broth. No one seemed to be paying them any mind, but even so, she was frightened. Lady Olena was growing impatient.
"Why are you gaping at Butterbumps? I asked a question. I expect an answer. Have the Lannisters stolen your tongue, child?"
Sir Dontus had warned her to speak freely only in the Guardswood.
King Joffrey, his grace is very fair and handsome and as brave as a lion."
"Yes, all the Lannisters are lions, and when a Tyrell breaks wind, it smells just like a rose," the old woman snapped. "But how kind is he? How clever? Is he a good heart, a gentle hand? Is he chivalrous as befits a king? Will he cherish Margaery and treat her tenderly, protect her honour as he would his own?"
"He will," Sansa lied. "He is very, very comely."
"You said that. You know, child, some say that you are as big a fool as Butterbumps here. And I am starting to believe them. Comely? I've taught my Margaery what comely is worth, I hope. Somewhat less than a mummer's fart. Arian Brightfire was comely enough, but a monster all the same. The question is, what is Joffrey?"
She reached to snag a passing servant.
"I am not fond of leeks. Take this broth away and bring me some cheese."
"The cheese will be served after the cakes, my lady.
The cheese will be served when I want it served, and I want it served now."
The old woman turned back to Sansa.
"Are you frightened, child?" "No need for that. We're only women here. Tell me the truth. No harm will come to you."
"My father always told the truth." Sansa spoke quietly, but even so it was hard to get the words out.
"Lord Eddard, yes. He had that reputation. But they named him traitor, and took his head off even so."
The old woman's eyes bore into her, sharp and bright as the points of swords. "Joffrey," Sansa said, "Joffrey did that.
He promised me he would be merciful and cut off my father's head. He said that was mercy, and he took me up on the walls and made me look at it. The head. He wanted me to weep, but... She stopped abruptly and covered her mouth.
I've said too much. Oh, gods be good, they'll know, they'll hear. Someone will tell on me.
Go on. It was Margaery who urged. Joffrey's own queen-to-be. Sansa did not know how much she had heard.
I can't.
What if she tells him? What if she tells? He'll kill me for certain, then.
Or give me to Sir Ilion.
I never meant... My father was a traitor. My brother as well. I have the traitor's blood. Please, don't make me say any more.
Calm yourself, child, the Queen of Thorns commanded.
She's terrified, Grandmother. Just look at her.
The old woman called to Butterbumps. Fool! Give us a song. A long one, I should think. The Bear and the Maiden Fair will do nicely.
It will, the huge jester replied. It will do nicely indeed. Shall I sing it standing on me head, my lady?
Will that make it sound better?
No.
Stand on your feet, then. We wouldn't want your hat to fall off. As I recall, you never wash your hair.
As my lady commands.
Butterbumps bowed low, let loose of enormous belch, then straightened, threw out his belly, and bellowed.
A bear there was, a bear, all black and brown and covered with hair.
Lady Olena squirmed forward.
Even when I was a girl, younger than you, it was well known that in the Red Keep the very walls have ears. Well, they will be the better for a song, and meanwhile we girls shall speak freely.
But, Sansa said, Varys, he knows, he always...
Sing louder,
the Queen of Thorns shouted at Butterbumps.
These old ears are almost deaf, you know. Are you whispering at me, you fat fool? I don't pay you for whispers. Sing!
The bear,
thundered Butterbumps, his great deep voice echoing off the rafters.
Oh, come, he said, oh, come to the fair. The fair, said he, but I'm a bear, all black and brown and covered with hair.
The wrinkled old lady smiled.
At Highgarden we have many spiders amongst the flowers. So long as they keep to themselves, we let them spin their little webs. But if they get underfoot, we step on them.
She patted Sansa on the back of the hand.
Now, child, the truth. What sort of man is this Joffrey, who calls himself Baratheon, but looks so very Lannister?
And down the row from here to there, from here to there, three boys, a goat, and a dancing bear.
Sansa felt as though her heart had lodged in her throat. The Queen of Thorns was so close she could smell the old woman's sour breath. Her gaunt, thin fingers were pinching her wrist. To her other side, Margaery was listening as well. A shiver went through her.
A monster, she whispered, so tremulously she could scarcely hear her own voice. Joffrey is a monster. He lied about the butcher's boy and made father kill my wolf. When I displease him, he has the king's guard beat me. He's evil and cruel, my lady. It's so. And the queen as well.
Lady Olena Tyrell and her granddaughter exchanged a look.
Ah, said the old woman. That's a pity.
Oh, gods, thought Sansa, horrified. If Margaery won't marry him, Joff will know that I'm to blame.
Please, she blurted, don't stop the wedding. Have no fear. Lord Pufffish is determined that Margaery shall be queen, and the word of a Tyrell is worth more than all the gold in Casterly Rock. At least it was in my day. Even so, we thank you for the truth, child.
Danced and spun all the way to the fair, the fair, the fair.
Butterbumps hopped and roared and stumped his feet. Sansa, would you like to visit Highgarden? When Margaery Tyrell smiled, she looked very like her brother Loras. All the autumn flowers are in bloom just now, and there are groves and fountains, shady courtyards, marble colonnades. My Lord Father always keeps singers at court, sweeter ones than butters here, and pipers and fiddlers and harpers as well. We have the best horses and pleasure boats to sail along the Mander. Do you hawk, Sansa?
A little, she admitted.
Oh, sweet she was, and pure and fair, the maid with honey in her hair.
You'll love Highgarden, as I do, I know it. Marjorie brushed back a loose strand of Sansa's hair. Once you see it, you'll never want to leave. And perhaps you won't have to.
Her hair, her hair, the maid with honey in her hair.
Shush, child, the Queen of Thorns said sharply. Sansa hasn't even told us that she would like to come for a visit.
Oh, but I would, Sansa said. Highgarden sounded like the place she'd always dreamed of, like the beautiful, magical court she had once hoped to find at King's Landing.
"Smell the scent on the summer air, the bear, all black and brown and covered with air."
"But the Queen," Sansa went on, "she won't let me go."
"She will. Without Highgarden, the Lannisters have no hope of keeping Joffrey on his throne. If my son, the Lord of Oath, asks, she will have no choice but to grant his request."
"Will he?" asked Sansa. "Will he ask?" Lady Orlena frowned.
"I see no need to give him a choice. Of course he has no hint of our true purpose."
"He smelled the scent on the summer air."
Sansa wrinkled her brow. "Our true purpose, milady?"
"He sniffed and roared and smelt it there, honey on the summer air."
"To see you safely wed, child,"
the old woman said, as Butterbumps bellowed out the old, old song,
"to my grandson."
"Wed to Sir Loras? Oh!" Sansa's breath caught in her throat. She remembered Sir Loras in his sparkling sapphire armour, tossing her a rose. Sir Loras in white silk, so pure, innocent, beautiful, the dimples at the corner of his mouth when he smiled, the sweetness of his laugh, the warmth of his hand. She could only imagine what it would be like to pull up his tunic and caress the smooth skin underneath, to stand on her toes and kiss him, to run her fingers through those thick brown curls and drown in his deep brown eyes. A flush crept up her neck.
"Oh, I'm a maid, and I'm pure and fair. I'll never dance with a hairy bear, a bear, a bear. I'll never dance with a hairy bear."
"Would you like that, Sansa?" asked Marjorie. "I've never had a sister, only brothers. Oh, please say yes. Please say that you will consent to marry my brother." The words came tumbling out of her. "Yes, I will. I would like that more than anything, to wed Sir Loras, to love him."
"Loras?"
Lady Olena sounded annoyed.
"Don't be foolish, child. Kingsguard never wed. Didn't they teach you anything in Winterfell? We were speaking of my grandson, Willas. He's a bit old for you, to be sure, but a dear boy for all that. Not the least bit oafish, and heir to Highgarden besides."
Sansa felt dizzy. One instant her head was full of dreams of Loras, and the next they had all been snatched away. "Willas? Willas?" "Why," she said stupidly. "Courtesy is a lady's armour. You must not offend them. Be careful what you say."
I do not know, Sir Willas. I've never had the pleasure, my lady. Is he as great a knight as his brothers?"
"Lifted her high into the air, the bear, the bear."
"No," Marjorie said. "He has never taken vows." Her grandmother frowned.
"Tell the girl the truth. The poor lad is crippled, and that's the way of it."
"He was hurt as a squire, riding in his first tourney," Marjorie confided. "His horse fell and crushed his leg."
"That snake of a Dornishman was to blame, that Oberon Martell, and his maester as well. I call for a knight, but you're a bear, a bear, a bear, all black and brown and covered with air."
"Willis has a bad leg, but a good heart," said Marjorie. "He used to read to me when I was a little girl and draw me pictures of the stars. You will love him as much as we do, Sansa."
She kicked and wailed the maid so fair, but he licked the honey from her hair. Her hair, her hair, he licked the honey from her hair.
When might I meet him? Asked Sansa, hesitantly.
Soon, promised Margaery. When you come to Highgarden, after Joffrey and I are wed, my grandmother will take you.
I will, said the old woman, patting Sansa's hand and smiling a soft, wrinkly smile. I will indeed.
Then she sighed and squealed and kicked the air. My bear, she sang, my bear so fair. And off they went from here to there. The bear, and the maiden fair.
Butterbumps roared the last line, leapt into the air, and came down on both feet with a crash that shook the wine cups on the table. The women laughed and clapped.
"I thought that dreadful song would never end," said the Queen of Thorns. "Ah, but look, here comes my cheese."
John. The world was grey darkness, smelling of pine and moss and cold. Pale mists rose from the black earth as the riders threaded their way through the scatter of stones and scraggly trees, down toward the welcoming fire strewn like jewels across the floor of the river valley below. There were more fires than Jon Snow could count, hundreds of fires, thousands. A second river of flickery lights along the banks of the icy white milk water. The fingers of his sword hand opened and closed. They descended the ridge without banners or trumpets, the quiet broken only by the distant murmur of the river, the clop of hooves, and the clacking of Rattleshirt's bone armor. Somewhere above, an eagle soared on great blue-gray wings, while below came men and dogs and horses and one white direwolf. A stone bounced down the slope, disturbed by a passing hoof, and John saw a ghost turn his head at the sudden sound. He had followed the riders at a distance all day, as was his custom, but when the moon rose over the soldier pines, he'd come bounding up, red eyes aglow. Rattleshirt's dogs greeted him with a chorus of snarls and growls and wild barking as ever, but the direwolf paid them no mind. 6 days ago, the largest hound had attacked him from behind as the wildlings camped for the night, but Ghost had turned and lunged, sending the dog fleeing with a bloody haunch. The rest of the pack maintained a healthy distance after that. Jon Snow's garron whickered softly, but a touch and a soft word soon quieted the animal. Would that his own fears could be calmed so easily. He was all in black, the black of the night's watch, but the enemy rode before and behind. Wildlings, and I am with them. Ygritte wore the cloak of Corrin Halfhand. Lennel had his hauberk, the big spare wife, Ragwill, his gloves. One of the bowmen, his boots. Corrin's helm had been worn by the short, homely man called Longspear Rick, but it fit poorly on his narrow head, so he'd given that to Ygritte as well. And Rattleshirt had Corrin's bones in his bag, along with the bloody head of Eben, who set out with John to scout the Skirling Pass. Dead. All dead but me. And I am dead to the world. Ygritte rode just behind him. In front was Longspear Rick. The Lord of Bones had made the two of them his guards.
If the crow flies, I'll boil your bones as well, he warned them, when they had set out, smiling through the crooked teeth of the giant skull he wore for a helm.
Ygritte hooted at him.
You want to guard him. If you want us to do it, leave us be, and we'll do it.
These are free folk indeed, John saw. Rattleshirt might lead them, but none of them were shy in talking back to him. The wildling leader fixed him with an unfriendly stare.
Might be you fool these others, Crow, but don't think you'll be fooling Mance. He'll take one look at you and know your force, and when he does, I'll make a cloak of your wolf there, and open your soft boy's belly, and sew a weasel up inside.
John's sword hand opened and closed, flexing the burned fingers beneath the glove. But Longspear Rick only laughed. "And where would you find a weasel in the snow?" That first night, after a long day of horse, they made camp in a shallow stone bowl atop a nameless mountain, huddling close to the fire while the snow began to fall. John watched the fakes melt as they drifted over the flames. Despite his layers of wool and fur and leather, he felt cold to the bone. Ygritte sat beside him after she'd eaten, her hood pulled up and her hands tucked into her sleeves for warmth.
"When Mance hears how you did for Halfhand, he'd take you quick enough," she told him.
"Take me for what?" The girl laughed scornfully.
For one of us. Do you think you're the first crow ever flew down off the wall? In your hearts, you all want to fly free."
"And when I'm free," he said slowly, "will I be free to go?"
"Sure you will." She had a warm smile, despite her crooked teeth. "And we'll be free to kill you. It's dangerous being free, but most come to like the taste of it."
She put her gloved hand on his leg, just above the knee.
"You'll see."
"I will," thought John. "I will see, and hear, and learn. And when I have, I will carry the word back to the wall." The wildlings had taken him for an oath-breaker, but in his heart he was still a man of the night's watch, doing the last duty that Corrin Halfhand had laid on him. "Before I killed him." At the bottom of the slope, they came upon a little stream flowing down from the foothills to join the milk water. It looked all stones and glass, though they could hear the sound of water running beneath the frozen surface. Rattleshirt led them across, shattering the thin crust of ice. Mance Raider's outriders closed in as they emerged. John took their measure with a glance, 8 riders, men and women both, clad in fur and boiled leather, with here and there a helm or bit of mail. They were armed with spears and fire-hardened lances, all but their leader, a fleshy blond man with watery eyes who bore a great curved scythe of sharpened steel. The Weeper, he knew at once. The Black Brothers told tales of this one. Like Rattleshirt and Harmer Dugshead, an Alfin Crowkiller, he was a known raider.
"The Lord of Bones,"
the Weeper said when he saw them. He eyed John and his wolf.
"Who's this, then?"
"A crow come over," said Rattleshirt, who preferred to be called the Lord of Bones, for the clattering armor he wore. "He was afraid I'd take his bones as well as our fans." He shook his sack of trophies at the other wildlings.
"He slew Corrin Halfhand," said Longspear Rick. "Him and that wolf is."
"And did for O'Rell too," said Rattleshirt. "The lad's a warg, or close enough," put in Ragwill, the big spear wife. "His wolf took a piece of Halfhand's leg."
The Weeper's red, rheumy eyes gave John another look.
"Aye. Well, he has a wolfish cast to him, now as I look close. Bring him to Mance. Might be he'll keep him."
He wheeled his horse around and galloped off, his riders hard behind him. The wind was blowing wet and heavy as they crossed the valley of the Milkwater and rode single file through the river camp. Ghost kept close to John, but the scent of him went before them like a herald, and soon there were wildling dogs all around them, growling and barking. Lennel screamed at them to be quiet, but they paid him no heed.
"They don't care much for that beast of yours," Longspear Rick said to John.
"They're dogs, and he's a wolf," said John. "They know he's not their kind. No more than I'm yours. But he had his duty to be mindful of. The task Corrin Halfhand had laid upon him as they shared that final fire, to play the part of turncloak, and find whatever it was that the wildlings had been seeking in the bleak, cold wilderness of the Frostfangs. Some power, Corrin had named it to the old bear, but he had died before learning what it was, or whether Mance Raider had found it with his digging. There were cook fires all along the river, amongst wains and carts and sleds. Many of the wildlings had thrown up tents of hide and skin and felted wool. Others sheltered behind rocks in crude lean-tos, or slept beneath their wagons. At one fire, John saw a man hardening the points of long wooden spears and tossing them in a pile. Elsewhere, two bearded youths in boiled leather were sparring with staffs, leaping at each other over the flames, grunting each time one landed a blow. A dozen women sat nearby in a circle, fletching arrows. "Arrows for my brothers," John thought. "Arrows for my father's folk, for the people of Winterfell and Deepwood Mott, and the Last Hearth. Arrows for the north." But not all he saw was warlike. He saw women dancing as well, and heard a baby crying, and a little boy ran in front of his garron, all bundled up in fur and breathless from play. Sheep and goats wandered freely, while oxen plodded along the river bank in search of grass. The smell of roast mutton drifted up from one cook fire, and at another he saw a boar turning on a wooden spit. In an open space surrounded by tall green soldier pines, Rattleshirt dismounted. "We'll make camp here," he told Lennel and Ragwell and the others. "Feed the horses, then the dogs, then yourself. Ygritte, Longspear, bring the crow so Mance can have his look. We'll gut him after." They walked the rest of the way, past more cook fires and more tents, with Ghost following at their heels. John had never seen so many wildlings. He wondered if anyone ever had. "The camp goes on forever," he reflected. "But it's more 100 camps than one, and each one more vulnerable than the last. Stretched out over long leagues, the wildlings had no defences to speak of, no pits, no sharpened stakes, only small groups of outriders patrolling their perimeters. Each group, or clan, or village, had simply stopped where they wanted, as soon as they saw others stopping or found a likely spot. The free folk. If his brothers were to catch them in such disarray, many of them would pay for that freedom with their life's blood. They had numbers, but the Night's Watch had discipline, and in battle, discipline beats numbers 9 times of every 10, his father had once told him. There was no doubting which tent was the king's. It was thrice the size of the next largest he'd seen, and he could hear music drifting from within. Like many of the lesser tents, it was made of sewn hides with fur still on. But Mance Raider's hides were the shaggy white pelts of snow bears. The peaked roof was crowned with a huge set of antlers from one of the giant elks that had once roamed freely throughout the Seven Kingdoms in the times of the First Men. Here, at least, they found defenders, 2 guards at the flap of the tent, leaning on tall spears with round leather shields strapped to their arms. When they caught sight of Ghost, one of them lowered his spear point and said, "That beast stays here." "Ghost, stay," John commanded. The direwolf sat. "Longspear, watch the beast." Rattleshirt yanked open the tent and gestured John and Ygritte inside. The tent was hot and smoky. Baskets of burning peat stood in all 4 corners, filling the air with a dim, reddish light. More skins carpeted the ground. John felt utterly alone as he stood there in his blacks, awaiting the pleasure of the turncloak who called himself King Beyond the Wall. When his eyes had adjusted to the smoky red gloom, he saw 6 people, none of whom paid him any mind. A dark young man and a pretty blonde woman were sharing a horn of mead. A pregnant woman stood over a brazier cooking a brace of hens, while a grey-haired man in a tattered cloak of black and red sat cross-legged on a pillow, playing a lute and singing.
"Oh, the Dornish man's wife was as fair as the sun, and her kisses were warmer than spring. But the Dornish man's blade was made of black steel, and its kiss was a terrible thing."
John knew the song, though it was strange to hear it here, in a shaggy hide tent beyond the wall, 10,000 leagues from the red mountains and warm winds of dawn. Rattleshirt took off his yellowed helm as he waited for the song to end. Beneath his bone and leather armor he was a small man, and the face under the giant's skull was ordinary.